Good morning. My name's Chris. I'm one of the elders here at Grace Church, and it's great to be with you this morning. If you haven't been with us before, then you're especially welcome. We are a multi-site church, which means we're also right now meeting in Chichester and also in Midhurst. And so we've got three sites. So if you normally live near there, or if you live near there and you're visiting today, then you could go to one of our churches. Obviously, you're welcome here too. It's good to gather together. We're going to be preaching from the Bible. So if you've got a Bible, turn to Matthew chapter 27. If you don't have a Bible, if you put your hand up, then one of the guys will bring it to you in your seat, put it up high, and sort of just keep it up until it comes to you. And if the reason your hand is up is because you don't own a Bible, then you can write your name in this one and keep it as a free gift from Grace Church. We'd love you to just have a copy of the Word of God and be able to read it. It will bless you. Before we get to the Bible, I just want to tell you a quick story that I heard about a woman who kept ducks. This woman kept ducks. And this woman brought a very sick-looking duck into a veterinary surgeon. And she said, she laid the pet down, this duck, on the table. And the vet pulled out a stethoscope to listen to the bird's chest, to the duck's chest. And after a moment or two, the vet shook his head, a bit sad, and said, "I'm really sorry, but your duck's dead. Dead duck." And the distressed woman replied, "Are you sure? Are you sure? I mean, he's not just any duck. He's a family pet, and I love him." And the vet replied, "Oh, I'm really sorry, but your duck's dead." And, how can you be sure? The woman started protesting. "What are you talking about? How can you be sure the duck is dead? You haven't done all the tests on him yet. All you've done is just listen to him. He could just be in a coma or something. And I want you to do more tests than just listen to him." And the vet sort of rolled his eyes, you know, because he knows what he's doing, and left the room. And he returned a few minutes later with a Labrador retriever, a black one. And as the duck's owner looked on in amazement, the dog stood on his hind legs and put his front paws on the examination table and started sniffing. And he sniffed around from the duck from the top to the bottom, and then he looked with sad eyes to the vet. Shook his head like this. And the vet patted the dog on the head and took it out of the room. And then he returned a few minutes later with a cat. And this time, the vet patted the dog, so the cat came in, and the cat jumped on the table and also dedicately went round and sniffed this dead duck and sniffed it from head to foot. And the cat sat back and again looked at the vet. "No, dead duck." And the vet looked at the woman and said, "Oh, I'm really sorry, but as I said, this is most definitely 100% a certifiably dead duck." And then he turned to his computer, turned his mouth, tapped on it a few times, and produced a bill and handed it to the woman. And the woman got the bill. £300? £300? How could it be this much? Just to tell me that my duck is dead." And then the vet shrugged and said, "Well, I'm really sorry, because if you just took my word for it, then the bill would have been £20. But instead, you insisted on having a lab report and a CAT scan." I thought it was funny. Anyway, Simo's off. He's had his nap. He's gone. We all know that death actually is permanent, don't we? When you're dead, you're dead. And the same is for a human as for a duck. You stay dead. Dead things don't come back to life. And it's not just people and animals that die. Lots of things die, actually, often. Sometimes life's hopes and dreams take a hit too, and they die. There are things that we hoped for, but somehow it didn't work out. Our hopes are dashed. Life disappoints us. Our hopes can die, and when that happens, it can be just as painful as bereavement sometimes. Lost hope can rob us of joy, and it can rob us of peace. It can take us down into depression and despair. And I want to talk today about restoring lost hope through our faith in Jesus. And so I've entitled this morning's talk, Restoring Hope When Life Has Let You Down. So we're going to be looking in Matthew. And at the heart of the Christian faith is a claim that if you believe in a supernatural God, or if you don't believe in a supernatural God, it's completely ridiculous. But if you do, then the claim is amazing. It's that a dead man, Jesus, came back to life. And not just any dead man, but a crucified dead man. And if we read the Gospels, the accounts of Jesus' life, they tell us all the same thing, that Jesus was arrested, that he was put on trial, that he was condemned to death, that he was beaten, he was stripped, he was whipped, and then he was crucified and nailed to a cross, nailed through his hands and his feet, and he died on that cross. The Roman soldiers, they were experts in crucifixion. At the time, these guys were the go-to guys. If you wanted someone dead, you go to these Roman soldiers, and they would do it by crucifixion. They were experts in the field. And those that crucified him did it. Thousands of people declared him dead. And to make extra sure, they stuck a spear into his heart, into the side of his heart. Jesus was taken down, he was buried in a tomb, and the door was sealed shut with a huge stone. You know, and there was good news to come. And the good things his followers had hoped for at that moment, though, were all dashed. They were gone. They had died. But the story doesn't end there. It follows on. And on the following Sunday morning, the first day of their working week, Jesus' followers discovered that he had been raised from the dead. And they went to embalm his body, and they discovered that the tomb was empty. The stone had been rolled away, as we've been singing this morning. And the grave clothes were neatly folded up. At first they were confused and they didn't know what to make of it, and then they saw him, and Mary was one of the first people to see him. And in her grief, she mistook Jesus, actually, for a gardener. She went and told the good news to the other disciples, but they also didn't believe it either until Jesus appeared to them. And they went and got poor Thomas, who wasn't with the other disciples at the time, and he didn't believe either until he sees Jesus for himself and his eyes are opened. The Bible goes on to tell us how Jesus, after the resurrection, appeared to many, many disciples. He ate with them. He taught them. He gave them convincing proofs that he was alive. And we're told by the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians 15 that on one occasion he appeared to over 500 people at one time. And then Paul adds, most of whom are still alive today. And so Paul is saying to the people reading the scrolls of 1 Corinthians, look, Jesus appeared to all these people, and if you don't believe it, go and speak to them, because they're still alive. Sometimes people try to reduce the resurrection of Jesus just to a metaphor. Well, he was resurrected in the followers' hearts. And every time we do good, we resurrect Jesus' hopes and dreams in our lives. And they say things like, you know, Jesus is alive in each one of us as we put his words into practice. Or by following his teaching, we can hope to make the world a better place. You know, that's all rubbish. That's rubbish. The Bible doesn't claim any of these things. And that is not the claim of Christianity at all. At the heart of the Christian faith is this incredible claim that Jesus rose from the dead physically, in a body. Christ has died, Christ has risen, and Christ will come again. And 2,000 years later, the resurrection of Jesus remains the single most important event in all of human history, and it's where Christians put their hope. True Christianity, actually, once we understand it, is not something that we can patronize and just say, oh, well, it's good for you, I'm glad that you believe it, it's nice for you, but it's not good for me, or it's not for me. We can't say those things. The Christian faith is built on this claim, and if true, it's the single most important fact in all of human history. And if it's true, it is life-changing news. And it's life-changing news that affects everyone, not just those that choose to believe it, but everyone. And if it's untrue, then it's an absolute scandalous lie that should be exposed. The one thing Christianity cannot be is just of moderate importance. And so this morning, what I want us to look at is we've got this whole scheme of events that I've sort of raveled off that we see in the Gospels. And what I want to look at is in the midst of all these events, there's a guy called Barabbas. And Barabbas is someone who, well, we'll find out in a moment. And what I want to do is I want to have a look at what happened in the events of Jesus and Barabbas and compare them to us today. So why don't you open up your Bibles then? Hopefully you're there already. Matthew 27, we're going to just read verse 15 on to 26. And so it says this. Now at the feast, the governor was accustomed to release for the crowd any one prisoner whom they wanted. So basically each year, they're at the feast at the moment, and each year the governor could release a prisoner that was held captive. Verse 16. And they had then a notorious prisoner called Barabbas. So when they had gathered, Pilate said to them, whom do you want me to release for you, Barabbas or Jesus, who is called Christ. For he knew that it was out of envy that they had delivered him up. Besides, while he was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent word to him. Just pause a second. So you've got this opportunity where someone could be released, and Pilate, he knows that Jesus is an innocent man. That's, he believes it to be true. He's already kind of cross-examined him and has found no fault in him. He's found no fault in Jesus, and he doesn't really understand why the Pharisees would want him crucified. And so in his heart, he knows the reason why they want him crucified is because they are envious of him. Because the Pharisees are people that they love God, and they go around preaching people the word of Scripture, and they are utterly hostile to the fact that this man Jesus could be God, because they don't believe that Jesus could take, or God could take, a human form. And so Pilate knows that the people that want him crucified are just envious of him, and so he thinks, oh, I know what I'll do, I'll just make a deal, because no one's going to want Barabbas, because Barabbas is a thief and a murderer. And what happens then is, as we just started to read, that verse 19, besides, while he was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent word to him, have nothing to do with the righteous man. That's have nothing to do with Jesus, for I have suffered much because of him today in a dream. So his wife has a dream about this guy Jesus. I think she has a premonition of who Jesus is. I think she has a vision from God that this guy Jesus is his son. Verse 20, now the chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowd to ask for Barabbas and destroy Jesus. So the chief priests, they're the ones saying, no, go get for Barabbas. We don't want Jesus around. And verse 21, the governor again said to them, which of the two do you want me to release for you? I think he's unconvinced. Surely they're not asking for Barabbas. And they said, Barabbas, give us Barabbas. And Pilate said to them, then what shall I do with Jesus, who is called the Christ? What shall I do with this man? He's innocent. And they all said, let him be crucified. Verse 23, and he said, why? What evil has he done? But they shouted all the more, let him be crucified. Verse 24, so when Pilate saw that he was gaining nothing, but rather that was a riot was beginning, he took water and washed his hands before the crowd, saying, I am innocent of this man's blood. See to it yourselves. And all the people answered, his blood be on us and our children. Then he released for them Barabbas, and having scourged Jesus, delivered him to be crucified. Wow. So we've got this story of Jesus and Barabbas, and it's one that's it's a bit mental, really. And I suppose a good question is that we've got is who is Barabbas? Who is this guy, Barabbas? So that's what we read. Who is Barabbas? Who is Barabbas? And why would this happen? You know, Pilate, when he's standing there, he holds the destiny of both men in his hands. And I think Pilate is actually a bit of a coward, because he knew what the right thing to do was. He knew that Jesus was an innocent man, and he should have released him. And instead, what he chooses to do is to go with the crowd. Why? Because he doesn't want a riot. He doesn't want his the place that he governs to be in complete, utter chaos. And so he gives into the crowd. But on one side of Pilate, you've got this murderer and thief, a crook, someone who has been judged rightly to be in the wrong. He's already been in prison all this time. He's been doing his time. He's probably in there for a life sentence. And on the other side, you have this innocent man, one that doesn't deserve any punishment at all, and the other who deserves crucifixion. Jesus, he is a one man who has gone around healing people. He has been kind to people. He has set people free. He is innocent. And, you know, we're reminded that Pilate's wife has already told him, no, don't do it. Don't get involved. Don't do anything to this man. And Pilate asked again. You know, he asked twice. "Who are you sure you really want Barabbas to be set free?" He asked him twice. And they say, yeah, Barabbas, give us Barabbas. And so he washes his hands. I can imagine Barabbas walking down the steps, going, oh, the people love me. They're shouting my name. Check me out. Look at me. The people love me. And I don't even know who this guy Jesus is, but check me out. I'm the man. Look at me. Barabbas, Barabbas, Barabbas. They're shouting his name. You know, we have no account of what happened to Barabbas after that. He probably went on and lived his life. He probably was proud of the things he did. Maybe he got a job. Maybe he built a house. Maybe he started having family and kids. And check me out. Look at me. I'm making something for myself. I've got clothes on my back. I've got a good job. I've got a career. And he's walking around, and he can be proud of all the things that he's accomplished for himself, what he's thinking. And he's the one standing there, taking all the adoration. And we didn't read it, but a few verses earlier, we would have read that Jesus is the one that stood there silent. He stood before Pilate silently. He knew, Jesus knew, that God has got to treat Jesus like Barabbas in order to treat Barabbas like Jesus. Barabbas thought that it was the people that had set him free. You know what? It was actually Jesus. Jesus had set Barabbas free by taking his place. Jesus took his place on the cross, the place that Barabbas should have had in the first place. And Barabbas is walking around, living life large. Check me out. I'm the man. And we have to ask this question, who's Barabbas? And I pondered that question. And I realized, flip, it's me. It's you. We're Barabbas. We're the ones that have been set free. We're the ones that deserved crucifixion. We're the ones that deserved death and punishment. Jesus didn't. We deserved it. And yet, because of Jesus' love for us, we have been set free. What a mug I am, maybe. And so, it was Jesus that brought Barabbas' life. And Barabbas would have lived through his life and probably thinking, look at all the things that I've accomplished for myself. How great am I? And yet, really, it was all because of Jesus. Everything that we have is because of Jesus. And what I want to do this morning is I want to look at four different things because, you know, Barabbas, he knew certain things about Jesus. And today, historians, whether they're Christians or not, will agree four things about Jesus, four main facts about Jesus. They all, pretty much, all historians will agree that Jesus was a real man. He wasn't a myth. He lived. He was a real man that lived a real life. They agree that Jesus was crucified by the Romans and that he was killed by the Romans, that he died on that cross. They agree with that. Historians agree with that. And Barabbas would have known that. They agree that Jesus' disciples believed that he had come back to life. And then the disciples went on and told people the good news. I mean, it's not myth. It's not made up. People look back in history and you can see accounts after accounts from within Christian scripture and books. And also outside, external sources, Tacitus would be one of them, that these events actually occurred. And interestingly, you might have seen in The Guardian, actually, just the other day, there was an article in there, and it was a journalist. What he was doing was asking this question, what is the historical evidence that Jesus Christ was alive, was a man that lived and then died? And at the end of the article, this is what he summarizes, that these abundant historical references leave us with little reasonable doubt that Jesus lived and died. The more interesting question, what goes beyond history, is whether Jesus died and then rose again and lived. And that I think that's a really good question, and that's what I want to have a look at, because this is a good question to ask us. And I believe that the resurrection of Jesus is historical fact. Let me tell you why. Because the Bible talks about the resurrection of Jesus as a real event. And it doesn't speak of it as a metaphor or just an idea. And so within a few years of Jesus' death, Christianity had spread all across the world. And Jesus' death and the spread of the early church is recorded by so many writers of the time. And people today sometimes try to suggest that the resurrection was made up. And that some people suggest that monks in the Middle Ages concocted this story, or the early Christians, or you know, a few hundred years later, decided to make up that Jesus really rose. But those theories just don't stack up, because the church was built from day one on the claims that Jesus had been resurrected. In fact, we can read at the time that when Jesus was dead and buried in the tomb, in the middle of that, from Good Friday to Easter Sunday, that the fishermen had gone back to their day job. They were back on the boat. When Mary went to find us, that's where they were. They were back on the boat. They'd gone back to the day job. They thought, oh, it's all over. It's done. And it's always been the central truth. And the early critics of the church, they knew that. And so historians of the day recorded it with disgust. And so the resurrection is not really actually a new claim, but it is the central claim. And so let's have a look. Here's some theories that some people have come up with. First of all, that it was made up years later, and we've kind of debunked that. It wasn't. It just doesn't tally with history or with critics of the early church, because that's what they were criticizing. And so it was the claim that Christians made from day one that Jesus was alive, and that was the message that they started to spread. So throughout Acts, the message they spread was of a resurrected and risen Jesus. Some people said it was made up by the original disciples, so they're saying, oh, it was made up from day one. But if that was true, then the Jewish and the Roman rulers could have shut down the church in week one. Why? Because they could have just produced the body. They said, well, here's the body. Here he is. We killed him, we buried him, here's the body. And so I don't think it's actually reasonable to say that the disciples did just make up this event. I don't think it's reasonable to say that. Because the other thing is that you could say that the disciples got confused and went to the wrong tomb. And again, it's a good try, but again, if that was true, then the Roman or Jewish rulers would have just produced the body. And they would have said, oh, well, yeah, they went to the wrong tomb, but here it is. Or they could say that Jesus wasn't really dead. And again, that's nonsense. But again, because we've mentioned about how the Romans were the guys. If you want someone dead, you go to the Roman guys, and they would kill them. They don't make mistakes like that. And when they pierced the side and it went into his heart, they would suggest that Jesus swooned on the cross, but he didn't. And they would suggest that he swooned and then recovered, but that couldn't have happened. And now we know that the mix of water and blood is a sign of death by asphyxiation, that he would have choked, basically, on the cross. He wouldn't have been able to breathe because of all the weight of his body pressing against his lungs. And that's what that sign shows. We know that now through medical research. The authority of Jesus' day didn't go, actually, for any of those ideas. The authority of Jesus' day decided we're not going to try to debunk what was going on by listing any of these. Instead, we're told that the authority decided, let's make up that the disciples stole the body. And the question is that really realistic? Because his disciples had all run away in fear of their lives when Jesus was arrested. They were a defeated bunch. They had no hope. There was a guard on the tomb. And the idea that this group of tax collectors and fishermen could stage a nighttime raid overpowering armed Roman soldiers is nonsense. Some historians would suggest that there's up to 16 Roman soldiers that were guarding the tomb at any one time. And it's made even more ridiculous when remember that every one of those disciples, apart from John, ended up dying for their claims. Some of them were crucified upside down. Some of them were beheaded. All these disciples were killed. And if they really knew that they just had stolen the body and they made it all up, then surely one of them, at some point in the midst of being crucified or in the midst of being hurt or damaged, they would have said, yeah, you know what, let's give it up. We made it up. Don't kill me. But they didn't do that. And also, not only that, they were witnesses of Jesus' dying on the day. And they were witnesses of Jesus performing many miracles. They witnessed all these things, and then because of those reasons, having seen Jesus risen, they went through. And all through history, since then, all around the world, there are millions of people who, although they are not eyewitnesses of the resurrection, they put their trust in Jesus, and they look at the central claims of Christianity. They look at what the disciples said, and they say, yes, we believe that it's true, that this Jesus, he died, but he is now alive, and he rose again. And to say it's true, if I'm one of them, I believe that this was true. I believe it happened. When I look at the historical evidence, when I look at all the other things that could have happened, this is the one that makes the most sense. This is the one that accounts for all the different parts of the events that add up to it. So the resurrection of Jesus is historical fact. And when we eliminate all the other possibilities, whatever remains, however unlikely, must be the truth. And that is that Jesus rose again physically. And so, it's good news. And the resurrection is not only historical fact. I do believe that it's good news. It is good news for us today. It's good news for us to listen to. And so let's just go back to Barabbas for a moment, because I want to show why it's good news, why this resurrection is good news. And that, the reason for that is because Barabbas, this mug who thought that he'd done it all by himself, the crowd was cheering him. What he needed to know is this, and what we need to know is this, that God took his place because he loved him. There's no record of him, as I said, there's no record of him saying sorry or thank you, but God loved him. And when we realize that we are Barabbas, then we say, why? Why would you do that? If God is God, then he would have known that Barabbas would just walk away. He would have known that Barabbas might not ever show him any love or any appreciation in return. And yet God still sends his son. And so we can read that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. It was in the midst of our sin that Christ died for the ungodly. It was in that position. It wasn't because he'd done anything. We could say, oh, well, Barabbas didn't deserve to be set free. No, he didn't. And when we come to know God and Jesus, we realize that we don't deserve to know his love either. And yet it's while we were still sinners that he loved us and he sent his son to die for us. It is possible that you could be living a life ignorant of the fact that Jesus has come and lived and died for you. And it's also possible that if you're a Christian, that you can live your life trying to do things to make it right. And you can say to yourself, oh, well, I deserve punishment. And I deserve poverty, and I deserve sickness, and I deserve shame. I deserve these things because I've done things wrong. And God says, no, I love you. God says, no, I sent my son to die for you. It was while you were a sinner that I did those things. And we can mess up, and we can think, oh, the way I need to pay him back is to work harder. You know, you are no match for the devil. You're no match for sin. All your good deeds, all your devotion, none of it will save you. There's only one person that will save you. The one who stood silent. One who stood there and let Barabbas be set free. Jesus overcame the grave, and he is the one that has done it all. He is the one that deserved to die. He is the one that deserved, Barabbas is the one that deserved to die and deserved to go on the cross, and yet Jesus took that punishment. And when we say, well, I deserve these things. Oh, you know, I've messed up in my marriage, and so I deserve divorce. Or I've messed up in this way, so I deserve to be stricken by debt. Or I've messed up in this way, and so I deserve to have a failed life. Or I deserve to be unemployed, or I deserve these things. Then God says, no, give me your shame. Give me your guilt. Give it all to me. I will take your place. His love is so great that he takes our sin, and instead he gives us righteousness. On that Friday, he went to the cross, and he went there in our place. And he says, go and live your life, and I will be with you to the very end of this age. You know, his blood is sufficient for your salvation. It's sufficient to save you, but it's also sufficient to sustain you and to satisfy you. Have you discovered hope? It's in Jesus that this hope can be restored. And John 3:16 tells us, God so loved the world that he gave his only son, whoever believes in him shall not perish but have everlasting life. And verse 17 goes on, for God didn't send his son into the world to condemn the world, but to save it through his son Jesus. Are you walking around in ignorance of God? Either because you never put your trust in him, and because you never come to him and said, Jesus, forgive me of my sin. Thank you for taking my punishment and death. Thank you for taking my shame. And giving you life, you can give your life to him. Equally, you might be a Christian, you might be not walking in all the goodness of what it means to be saved by grace. I would encourage you, when we come to moments in our lives and we feel guilty, and we feel guilt or shame or weakness or suffering or trial or trouble, we can come before God and we say, God, thank you that you took my ultimate shame and my ultimate guilt. Will you stand with me in this trial? Will you stand with me in this trouble? He restores hope even when life has let us down. He gives us hope and a future. Without the resurrection, all we have is lost hopes and a dead martyr. With it, we have good news and hope restored. The Bible tells us that the cross, that Jesus paid the price for our sin, he was punished in our place, and at the cross, God the Father poured out on Jesus the wrath of the sin of the world. The Father turned his face away from Jesus, and Jesus cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me? Jesus died and became sin for us so that we might become the righteousness of God. He was cut off from God so that we never have to be. It's good news, isn't it? Isn't it good news? Good news of the resurrection. So I wonder what things do you have? What hopes and fears have you got over your lives? Are there areas where you've hoped for something? You don't get to live long in this world without experiencing pain and disappointment. But the resurrection of Jesus is good news because it points us beyond the pain of this life, beyond the disappointments, to the new life to come. Not only can we be forgiven of our sin, but we can come into a relationship with God. And we also receive the promise of resurrection ourselves. It's not a spiritual wishy-washy life. It's not a never-never land. It's not a floating in the cloud on a harp. It's a physical resurrection in a physical body to a new life under a new heavens and a new earth. And so you might think, oh, I had hoped, and this life has disappointed me. But this life is not the end. You know, we will have a new life to come that will be free of pain and disappointment and suffering and sickness and disease. And if we're going to live this life with hope, we need to have an eternal perspective. We need to realize that even death is not the end, because we serve a God of resurrection. We have another life to come. And so the resurrection of Jesus, it points us to the life to come. Christ has died, Christ has risen, and Christ will come again. And so for those who believe in him, Christ has died so that our sins are forgiven and we can know God. Christ has risen so that death is defeated and we will be raised with him to new life, and Christ will come again and we will be with him and be raised and reign with him for all eternity. The last thing I just want to touch on is this, and that is that the resurrection of Jesus, we know it's good news and it gives us a reason for hope, and even when life has let us down, but that we can know these things. But and love, you know, love may let you down. People may let you down. Even the church might let you down. But Jesus will never let you down. And this event demands a response. The resurrection of Jesus, it demands a response. Because we've all have sinned and we all have fallen short of God's glory. We don't know Barabbas' response. But I know mine, and I know many of yours in this room. You can ignore it. You could pretend that it's a myth. You could walk through life and forget the fact that the reason why you have life and life to abundance and air to breathe is because there was this guy, Jesus, that lived 2,000 years ago that died for you. There's a guy called Paul. His name was actually Saul before. And what happened was that he used to go around killing Christians and persecuting them. And Jesus appeared to him after he had died and rose again. He appeared to him and he changed his name to Paul. And Paul, his whole life changed. Rather than killing Christians, he started going out to the world, to the Romans and to the people that didn't know God, and telling them about Jesus. And in Acts 13, we can read about when Paul preached a particular sermon. And what happens is he gets lots of different responses. Some people begged to hear more the next week. And if maybe you're hearing some things this morning for the first time, and I want to encourage you to come again next week. Come and hear more. Come and find out more. Some of the Jews responded to the message, and they believed. Some people believed. Maybe you need to do that today. Maybe you need to put your trust in Jesus. I want to trust you. Some people got angry with the message. And said, oh, well, it's just rubbish, or it's just annoying, and they were just upset about it. And maybe you're upset and angry about the message today. And again, I would ask yourself, why? Why are you angry about it? Why not open yourself up to this joy and peace that you can find? Come again. Come and find out more. Paul and Barnabas, they actually went on and spoke to lots and lots of different people, and many, many believed. And now we get to the point where there's over 2 billion people all around the world that believe in this message, that Christ has died, Christ has risen, and Christ will come again. And this risen Jesus asks you to make a response, and that response is this. Will you follow him? Sorry, I was meant to have a slide there saying, will you follow him? Will you follow Jesus? Will you follow him? Let's not, am I still on? Yeah. Let's not live our lives ignorant of the fact that Jesus has rose again. Don't do a Barabbas. Don't do a Barabbas. He lived his life and didn't walk in all the goodness that it is. And so if you don't know God, then this morning you can, and you can put your trust in him. And if you do know God, then I want to encourage you that he's not just good enough to save you, but he is good enough to sustain you and to satisfy you. And so for all those things, all those hopes and those desires and all those things that are troubling you in life and all those things that might have let you down and brought you, I don't know, shame or guilt or dissatisfaction, you know, we can lay them at the cross. We can lay them at Jesus' feet because he was risen again. He has defeated all those things. And it doesn't mean that it's going to become any easier apart from the fact that he will walk with you through life. He will walk with you through every single circumstance. Throughout the course of his public ministry, Jesus knew both the adoration and the desertion of crowds. People followed him, but also people unfollowed him. Today, just as 2,000 years ago, the resurrection asks a question and demands an answer. Will you follow Jesus?